With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Zama Mia, here we go again. It's the Curzon Film Podcast. I'm Jake Cunningham, and this week we're talking about Lucretia Martel's slightly maddening, always entertaining, twisting river of bureaucracy, Zama. Taking the journey upriver this week, we've got regular contributor Kelly Powell.
Hello.
And we've got the man who decides what you're going to see and when you're going to see it, programming manager Ben Linden.
Hey there.
And from the film magazine that will put even the cinematography of Zama to shame with its sheer beauty, it's Hannah Woodhead, social producer for Little White Lies.
Hi there.
We were doing well, guys?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, ready to get stuck into Zama. This has been talked about on film Twitter relentlessly for about 9 months now, so it's nice that people are finally going to actually be able to see this. It's about a man named Don Diego de Zama who kind of gets trapped in the bureaucracy of the colonial life that he's trapped in Paraguay after leaving Argentina. Hannah, you could give us a background on this. Is it just a colonialoscopy, really?
It is adapted from a novel written by Antonio Di Benedetto. I hope I'm saying that right. Who wrote this book in 1956. It was only translated into English last year, by the New York Review of Books. And it's about, yeah, Don Diego de Zama, who is an officer of the Spanish Crown who is stationed in Paraguay and wants to get out of Paraguay, and due to all the bureaucracy is not allowed to leave, and it's his sort of slow descent into madness, kind of Apocalypse Now, but from the point of view of Kurtz, is how I would describe it.
I think that this is a familiar story, the upriver madness. Like we've seen it in Apocalypse Now, and we're all familiar with Heart of Darkness. But I think from a tonal perspective, we're more in territory of Aguirre, The Wrath of God, in that there's that underlying hint of black comedy throughout. And she's even talked about this as being a comedy. So just to give a bit of background on the film, this film's reception, it premiered at Venice Film Festival last year. It was outside of competition and it instantly has received rave reviews. Hannah, your own publication has given this a full 5 stars, declaring it even one of the masterpieces of the 21st century. Is that something you would stand by?
Yeah, 100%. We were in sort of unanimous agreement on the editorial team, which does not happen that often, that this is an absolute masterpiece. We ran the review and an interview with Lucretia Martel in this issue. I think she's one of the best interview subjects I've read in a very long time. She did our interview, she did an interview with Film Comment, she did a Q&A at the BFI the other night, and she's just very funny, very sharp, very intelligent, and has wonderful things to say about her work and what inspires her. And Zama in particular, I think, she's just so passionate about it, and she's so eloquent. And reading that kind of in tandem with seeing the film is, I think, really a great thing to do. It's one of those films you can't just watch and then forget about. You kind of want to absorb everything around it as well.
One of the reasons that we've got Ben in today is that this is a really interesting property because in Variety, Guy Lodge wrote that commercially, Zama couldn't be a much tougher sell. And this film is coming out on the same day as a Star Wars film. And so, Ben, I've got to ask you, when you're watching this film, what are you thinking about other than this is brilliant? You've got to think of it from another angle of how are we going to get people to watch this as well?
Yeah, very true. So I think, I mean, Star Wars is probably going to be in upwards of 600 screens across the country, or 600 cinemas across the country, countless more screens, versus, I think, at last count, probably about 14 cinemas in the country that are going to be showing Zama. So, you know, a bit of a margin there. I think, you know, we are sort of in a luxury within Curzon Cinemas in that this is the sort of film that, that some of our customers are happy to be challenged by. You know, it's certainly as sort of narratively spare, and, you know, there's almost zero exposition in there, which can make for quite a frustrating watch for some viewers. But for those who are willing to be challenged by that, who, you know, want to work to try and find the meaning behind it, you know, it's kind of like peeling away the skins of an onion to try and find out what's going on underneath there. In fact, I think I saw a recent quad poster, which actually kind of looks like that with different sort of concentric circles. Yeah. But yeah, it's worth working for, I think, in the end. It's a very rewarding film as a result.
Yeah. It's interesting that just in that short time, I think you said the word challenge two or three times, which I think is very much a key word when you're watching this film, particularly in the first maybe half hour, 40 minutes even. Lucretia Martel doesn't give you any information. She doesn't tell you even what country you're in, where you are, who anyone is, what role they have. You are just figuring it out along the way. And in that respect, it is quite hard to get into at the very beginning, but it's one of those films that you eventually get drawn into.
Mm-hmm. I always like it when that happens, so you kind of have to figure it out. But it kind of places you in his headspace immediately, you know? And the first half an hour is kind of, as you say, a challenge to get to kind of get into, because you're figuring all this stuff out and it's kind of like, oh God, colonialism and period piece, and you're not quite sure where it's going, and then it slowly starts to take a different form.
So really there's only one objective in the film, and that's for Zama to leave.
Yeah.
And that's all
you
he
feel
wants
that
to
in
do.
The first half an hour, you're like, yeah.
And in a way people might hear that synopsis and think of it as being like saying this is very Kafkaesque and this is the trial and he just wants to get out, but I think that puts quite a rigid description on it, because I don't think it is like that. There's a lot more fluidity to this, and I think there's a lot more curiosity in how the comedy is executed, where the jokes come from. Like, it almost verges on like Blackadder or something at some point. So it's actually she's got a real eye for silliness even, but using that to heighten the sense of comedy in the futility of Zama's situation.
Yeah, I think much of the comedy comes, like, it's aimed towards him essentially, isn't it? He's like this sort of classic anti-hero type character, and this is established very early on when you see him sort of perched magisterially looking out across I guess it's a river because we're inland, wearing a tricorn hat and this sort of rich burgundy jacket. He looks very, you know, sort of imperious, but he's quickly sort of knocked off his pedestal as he's caught spying on a group of women who are bathing in the river, and this is another point of ridicule throughout the film, is his sexual frustrations. Mm. He's trying to be reunited with his wife and kids, but at the same time he's incredibly lonely, and he spends a lot of the film chasing after wife of a treasurer, Signora Luciana,
who treats him with such contempt. She's sort of amused by him, but she's very much in the thing that I found refreshing about her character. At first, she's positioned as sort of like this floozy who's just been stationed, she's just having a good time, but it comes very apparent she knows exactly what she's doing, and when they're having meetings you can just tell she just has him on a string. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I really like about the character of Zama is he is the point of ridicule in this film, is him and colonialism. It becomes like, it's not in any way
a film that celebrates colonialism, which I think a lot of period pieces do, even accidentally. This is a straightforward critique of colonialism, and Zama's character is just this sad old man who's been put out to pasture by the Spanish crown, and he watches all these other his colleagues get sent away and
for doing something wrong.
Yeah,
they get rewarded. Yeah,
and I think he tries, but no, he can't get sent away.
It's the butt of the joke all the time.
The first hour and 10 minutes is just staying within this one small outpost and just watching Zama try and get a letter to leave. And it's amazing that it is stretched for that long, essentially one joke. But it's completely entertaining and enthralling throughout all of that. And I just want to dip into the form of the film for a while. I think the cinematography is really interesting for the way that it traps Zama. I think there's a lot of shooting through frames of doors or windows, or actually the way that people are blocked to condense space, making things closer and closer and really getting that entrapment. There's even a scene where I think it's in a stable, and rather than just walk through a door to get into the stable, he has to kind of climb through a window. And it's just making almost this progressive movement for Zama is just such a struggle at all times, particularly as well because it looks so hot and he just looks dirty and sweaty, and you're very aware of the fact he's probably got about 5 layers on, and so does everyone else. And just the act of doing anything in this situation just looks like a task.
Yeah, so I think this is like, again, this is sort of relates to this critique of colonialism, and there's a parable that you hear quite early on in the film that's told by a native about this fish who spends its entire life fighting with the water, which wants to throw it out onto the shore. It rejects it essentially, and this is kind of an allegory for Spanish in this case being in South America, and you know their sort of their formalities and graces, the silly wigs and pompous costumes that they wear, and you know the perfunctory kissing each other on the cheek when they greet each other. It's just completely out of place in this climate, and this is something you see. I mean, it's clearly a sort of driving force behind Zama wanting to get out of there as well. But you see servants fanning them, you know, they're sort of, and carrying them around on their backs. And going back to the to your point about the cinematography as well, it's a very sort of clear style of Martel's to have these sort of figures in the background who are sort of cut off. Their heads are cut off. In fact, she uses it in a previous film, the headless woman, to sort of denote this concussed state that the protagonist is in this film as well. But here you're seeing these sort of subjugated natives who don't really have a role within the film.
Mm. And just thinking of that scene, as you say, in which there's one of the slaves in the background who's just fanning Luciana and Zama, and that scene goes on for probably between 5 and 10 minutes. The whole way through, you've got the sound of this fan going on.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And I think the sound throughout the film is another key element in really building that atmosphere. There's one particular technique that's deployed 3 times, which is the tone that's used in Dunkirk as well, this constantly dropping note. which is kind of this audio illusion of a note that kind of overlays on itself. So it sounds like it's constantly dropping and just getting more and more intense, but you could just keep playing it forever and it would just trick your ears into thinking it's always getting lower. And so Hans Zimmer used this in the score for Dunkirk to just build up that tension. And it's used a few times in Zammer just as something clicks for Zammer and a plan of his has not worked. Like, for instance, I think it happens when he gets told that he's not leaving for however long, and then this tone clicks in, and then that just clues us in for another descent into a bit more madness.
Does this happen in the llama scene, which everyone is talking about?
God,
because I remember the llama scene is probably my favourite part of the film. But, yeah, he's having this conversation with his superior officer who's telling him, you're stuck here, basically, and this llama waltzes in and sort of looks around and it's treated like this just happens. But, yeah, he kind of, Zammer, like, tunes out.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really matter what the guy is saying to him. It's like, okay, well, here we go again.
Yeah. Record scratch. You're probably wondering how I ended up here.
And also the music that Martel uses is really interesting in this film. She uses this surf rock band from the 50s.
Love it.
50s, 60s, which is totally anachronistic to the setting of the film. And I was reading an interview in Film Comment with her, and she said she chose this because she was very aware that this band were around the same time that Antonio Di Benedetto was writing the novel. And she liked the idea of using music that he probably would have been aware of. And I think it works so well. And it's so funny hearing this kind of like surf rock as Zammer's just slowly losing his mind.
Well, it's kind of like this Hawaiian Third Man theme at points. It's really lovely. And even just writing the notes out for this show yesterday, listening to that, and it's really lovely and calming and just such a contrast to actually what's going through Zammer's head.
I read also, I think it was a Slant interview, where she talks about the sound. She likes the sound to force the audience to sort of see beyond the image, which I like. It like adds a complexity to it, and it kind of makes you aware of his surroundings, even though he's not necessarily aware of it. You know, you often hear like the fanning of the sound of the fan is one of them. It's really loud and you're kind of always aware of it. And the buzzing of the flies as well, like often it's just like this sound that sort of infiltrates out like as the audience.
Yeah. Well, so often that kind of sound is there just for Atmos to make it sound like a real place, but she brings it
and heightens it. Yeah, she highlights it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So Hannah, going back to Benedetto's book, along with El Silenciero and Los Suicidas, this is the third part in his trilogy of expectation. I wonder how we think of, I think that word is very key to the themes of this film.
Yeah, I think Zammer's expectations, the expectations that the Crown have of him as a officer, the expectations of the of colonialism, I guess. There's a great metaphor in this film that I a very on the nose metaphor, but I love it nonetheless, where they're talking about spider wasps. They keep talking about spider wasps. They love the spider wasps, which I was talking about this the other day as well. I personally love spider wasps. I think they're really cool, really metal as a creature. And spider wasps will lay their eggs inside living spiders, and then the eggs hatch and eat the spider from the inside out, which is disgusting but very cool. And it's a whole metaphor for colonialism in the film. But also Zammer, the way this island kind of eats away at him until he's just this like sad husk of a man. And you kind of think of it, the word expectation for me always brings to mind Great Expectations, and this is like the opposite of that, like just no expectations at all. By the end of the film, he sets off on this kind of like quest in order to redeem himself, to find this mythical bandit. And he's, you know, the whole way through they talk about this guy, Vincuna Porto, and it's like, oh, Vincuna Porto. There's all these rumours that he's dead, and there's a horrible scene where this guy's like talking about killing him. And then right at the end, there's like another record scratch moment, and Zammer's face is just like, oh, yeah. He just loses any sort of hope of leaving. And yeah, I think that's really, I'm not aware of Benedetto's work, and I'm very interested to go and read Zama now and read these other books as
Well. Yeah, well, if it was only last year that, due to this adaptation, that we got a translation of Zama, perhaps we'll be getting translations of the other ones as well. Let's briefly talk about Vicuna Porto, because he's almost the rosebud of this film. In a way. It
took me a while to know what they were talking about. So who is and it's great. It's like they constantly talk about this Porto character. You have no idea. Zama has no idea who he is. At the beginning, he gets I don't think it's a spoiler to say he gets robbed. And everyone's like, so Vicuna Porto has done it. And it's this Chekhov's gun. You're waiting for the gun to go off all the way through.
And at one point, there's a gambling match going on, and someone's trophy is that they've got Vicuna Porto's ears cut off and tied around a string.
Yeah, I think it's the governor, isn't it, who's sort of like proudly wearing it. In fact, I think at one point it gets sort of fashioned into a brooch and pinned on him by one of his servants, and he's sort of like dearly like fondling it and sniffing it like a trophy. It's incredibly weird. But this is the funny thing about this character is that he, as you say, Henry, has this sort of kind of like mythological quality. He's like a sort of like a Robin Hood or a Dick Turpin or something like that, who apparently has been killed thousands of times before. He's been executed, and then in the final act, we come face to face with this person who at least claims to be Vicuna Porto, but may not in fact actually be him. But there's a very interesting line going back to this sort of quality of expectation that that Zama says to him right at the end, and he says, I do for you what no man did for me. I say no to your expectations. And it seems like this is finally the point at which he's given up on you know, any kind of hope of ever getting home again. And this is his problem, is that he's, you know, throughout the film, he's not able to manage his expectations. Yeah. He's very sort of entitled to what should rightfully be his. And that is the driving force behind the film.
Well, it's interesting as well, because I don't know if it's a spoiler and you can cut this if it is, but it's interesting that you say that, because it's almost like this idea of hope and dreams and like these expectations are obviously, and the repetition, you know, the record scratch thing is happening like throughout, even with dialogue, you know, narratively speaking. But at the end, almost when he sort of surrenders because there's no other option, there is almost this feeling of hope, you know, where you kind of like, okay, well, maybe if he just kind of surrendered to his environment from the beginning, that he would have led a happier life. I don't know.
There's that beautiful scene. The final scene of the film is absolutely gorgeous. Stunning. And there's the final line in the film is like one of the best lines in the film, because it's almost got this like River Styx quality to it, the whole scene. And this child, I think it's a child that has the final line in a film. And there's the dialogue is so on point, and I don't know how much of it comes from the book and how much of it is Martel.
Well, and how much is in the translation that we're getting as well.
Yeah, there's a great line from Luciana to Zama when they're having one of the long conversations, and she says, Europe is best remembered by those who were never there, which is this kind of mythology within the film and the idea of how it was in the old days. And that's still a thing now of people, even in England, thinking like, oh, it was so much better like 20, 40 years ago. People really like wanting to go back to that, which I think it's widely agreed that was not a good time.
Problematic there.
Rose-tinted lenses.
Well, it's interesting that you brought that up, because I read, I think it was in the film comment interview, that this idea of like Europe was best remembered by those who were never there is her idea. It like represents Argentina at large for her, like as a nation, and their sort of struggle with their national identity of sort of these upper and middle class Argentines like feeling like they're Europeans stuck in Latin America, yearning to go back to their country that kind of was never, you know.
And they're seeking all these goods. There's a whole thing with a smuggler early on. I think he was a smuggler, I'm not entirely sure, but he's bringing these imports in. Spoiler, it doesn't end well for him, that whole business. But, they're wanting to be more European.
They call him the Oriental.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
And trying to dominate the landscape and change the landscape around them to fit. And the thing that's refreshing about this film is the landscape like buys back. And it's like, no.
Yeah, particularly in the final half hour is where we escape the colony and really head into, I don't know what this kind of landscape is called to me. It looks like more of an Everglades-y type situation. And that's where the camera really breaks out and the colours really change. And that's when we really begin to see the hopelessness of Zama's situation.
And the way Martel uses hopelessness is, I compared it earlier to Apocalypse Now or Heart of Darkness, and in there, hopelessness is such a kind of bleak thing. But in this film, it doesn't seem bleak. As hopeless as it is, there is this kind of like feeling that Zama, as horrible as he is, it doesn't feel like a bleak film to me. I came out of it and I was like, oh, it all feels like a fever dream almost.
And the form implies more freedom as he has less hope as well, like, that we break out further the more broken down he gets.
More he surrenders himself to the environment, the more the less is in the village. And he takes this mission which takes him away from the outpost.
And it does seem like this, you know, there's potentially more than one reading, perhaps not in the book, but maybe just this is Martel's adaptation of it, of this final third of the film, with whether this is just a sort of imagined reverie of his, because you do see him sort of slowly losing his sanity throughout the film, and prior to this he's sort of in this feverish state, and he's imagining things of this, there's this woman who's walking around in this crumbling lodgings that he's been placed in who isn't actually there. And you feel that perhaps this mission that he volunteers for is just a way that he might be sort of perceived as less ridiculous, to capture this sort of elusive bandit. Might finally be his ticket out of there, but at the same time it just seems like completely unlikely, and it's so surreal, everything that happens there, and incredibly violent. It's completely at odds with the rest of the film cinematically.
Well, I think we need a ticket out of here. And so we're probably going to have to wrap up our Zama chat there, I'm afraid. We could probably go on for a lot longer on this. Yeah. I'm sure we do really love this film. But it's not the only film out this week. In fact, there is one big film about... It's kind of this individual adventure for a famous Star Wars character. You could say it was a Han Solo.
Ha, 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 ha. I'm glad you got a joke in, because I've been trying every opportunity... My blog as a teenager was Han, Solo. So I saw this film the other night. If you're a fan of Star Wars, go and see it. You know, that's all I'm gonna say.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm a fan of Star Wars, so I'll see it. You've sold it, Han. Great. I'll read that extended review in the Nestle's White Lies. You can actually check out some other great stuff on Curzon Home Cinema, including Jean Femme, which came out last week. And the new release, which comes out today, is The Post, the Steven Spielberg film with Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks and a whole host of wonderful people. And so you can check that out this weekend as well if you don't fancy going to the cinema. But if you've got any thoughts on Zama, do let us know by emailing podcast@curzon.com. And we'll be reading them out on next week's show, which is going to be on La Monte Double. Anyone want to give me a pronunciation on that?
Double.
Double. That's much better. La Monte Double. And that's the new Francois Ozon picture. If you haven't already, do subscribe on iTunes and Acast or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review or a comment if you like as well. But until next time, it'll be goodbye from Kelly.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Ben.
Goodbye.
And goodbye from Hannah.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.